You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
David Thompson, the film historian, film critic, and educator, is my guest. He's the author of many books, including The Moment of Psycho, How Alfred Hitchcock Taught America to Love Murder, How to Watch a Movie, and his latest, A Light in the Dark, A History of Film Directors. He's also a film director of documentary films about film. David Thompson, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for having me.
I was watching Casablanca recently, and my wife said, why are you watching this movie when you know it by heart, you know every word? And I said, well, there's a lot of songs, you know every word, but it doesn't mean you don't want to hear them again.
Absolutely, yeah.
But you said something about Red River that I thought was even better. You said watching it again was like getting on a carousel ride.
Yeah, I mean, Red River is the first film I saw twice in one day. I was taken to see it when I was like 8 by an aunt, and I watched it in reverie. And the film ended, and she said, well, come along, let's go now. And I said, no, I want to see it again. And those were in the days when films were continuous showing, so you could sit around and see it again. And I argued with her, and she said she would go shopping so long as I behaved and stayed in the theater, took the risk. And I saw it twice in one day. And I just loved it to the extent that I wanted to be there on the screen in the West, but really on the screen. And I keep watching it. I have a son who is named Matthew after one of the characters in the film. And obviously, it is the same film, and it's dated in certain ways. But you know as well as I do that if you see a film over a long enough period, you grow, you change. Maybe you grow up, maybe you grow down, I don't know. But you change. And the film, it becomes open to different meanings. And I love that aspect to it. And I mean, you know, Casablanca is a very interesting case in point because I think it's clear now that the Ilsa character is really pushed around by the guys. She doesn't get to make up her mind which one she wants to be with. That's really untenable today. The woman would have to have more agency, more say in it. So, you know, we've changed. The film has changed because of that.
Yes. Well, so has that happened with Red River or other films that, I mean, with Red River, there's so many jokes in it that an 8-year-old wouldn't get.
Absolutely.
Or wouldn't even know that jokes, there were jokes there.
Yes.
And then there's a certain point where you're like 30 and you watch it again and go, oh my God, I didn't see any of that.
Well, I mean, for me, it's a father-son story. Although at the time I saw Red River, I was not aware of it fully, but I was going to have a very difficult relationship with my father. So that as I saw the film when I was like 10 or 12 or 14, it began to take on different meanings because of what was happening to me in my life. And obviously at first I was entirely on the side of the Montgomery Clift character. But now I've grown older and I have sons who maybe don't always do exactly what I think they should do. Thank God. You know, you begin to sympathize more with the Wayne character. And it's obviously a film I saw at the right time. And we are all of us, I think, terribly vulnerable to the movies we saw in childhood because we buy into a certain world vision in them, which is probably fraudulent, but it has a lot to do with making us who we are.
A frightening thing happened to me the last time I watched A Hard Day's Night.
Oh, really?
The scene where the Beatles are in the train with this old guy and he doesn't want them to play the radio and he doesn't want them to have the window open and they leave him and there's this sort of surreal thing. Well, you know, when I was a kid, I thought the Beatles were cool and that old man was so stuffy, but now I'm on the old man's side. I don't want a bunch of kids
Well, I remember going back to Dartmouth where I had taught in the 70s. This was in the 90s, maybe, or even later. And talking to a few students, and they were doing a class that they were looking at Rebel Without a Cause at that time. Now, Rebel Without a Cause for me was a formative film, like Red River. And I said, oh, does it still stand up? And they said, oh, God, those kids, are they pains in the neck? Wild babies. I really see it through the point of view of the parents, these kids were saying. Now, that's an amazing change, you know. I mean, just like your change response to the old man in the train carriage.
Because I read your book, A Light in the Dark, A History of Movie Directors, and really enjoyed it all, but I was enjoying the chapter on Hawks. And I watched a couple of Hawks films that I somehow had missed. One of them was like an obvious one, and I don't know why I'd never seen it. It was Cary Grant's I Was a Male War Bride.
Male War Bride, yeah. It was not a very well-known film.
Pretty hilarious. And then I watched Man's Favorite Sport with Rock Hudson and Paula Prentice, which in some ways is the same movie.
Yeah. Well, Hawks did make the same movie over and over again. And sometimes almost the same dialogue occurs in certain films.
What is it about Hawks that appeals to you?
Oh, it's a very old-fashioned, kind of shameful male chauvinism now, which I grew up with as a kid. And although I disapprove of it now, I cannot entirely disown it. I know we are supposed to disown these myths that we grew up with, but the truth is that myths like that go very deep. And what Hawks had that a lot of American directors didn't have was that they would play the myth, the hard-boiled guy, the woman, they get into an argument, always an argument and a quarrel before they fall in love. And he was always making fun of it. I think what I like about Hawks above all is his notion that movies are not really as serious as a lot of film criticism tries to say they are. They're fun. And I think one of the things that is happening to movies now is that we are losing that sense of fun. So I think when he made a Western, he had the fun with it in the sense that he told his actors, the actors in Rio Bravo, they're not really out in the old West. They are actors of the late 1950s wearing cowboy clothes and going through certain routines and playing with them. And it's the playfulness, the fun in Hawks that I like above all. And I don't like him whenever he gets totally serious, which isn't very often. He usually is teasing and mocking the story he's telling because he knows it's an old story that's been told many times. But that's the thing about him that I like. Plus, he was just so expert. A very non-show-off camera style, but a way of shooting things so that you got the information quickly, you appreciated the actors for what they were doing, and it was there in an instant. And I love that immediacy to his films. And for me, he is the epitome of the golden age of Hollywood. And I think we should all be very wary of the golden age of Hollywood because it told us so many lies and they've had profound effects on the way we live. But they did entertainment. Casablanca is a great example. They did entertainment for millions, for virtually everyone, about as well as has ever been done anywhere. And I love that quality.
You mentioned Rio Bravo. What I think is most remarkable about that film isn't when they break out into song, but that they break out into another song.
Yes, that's right. because they're having fun. Oh, let's do another one.
Yeah. Well, Casablanca and Michael Curtiz, who you just kind of mention in your book, really don't talk about him too much. And I find him an interesting comparison with Hawks, because I guess Hawks is considered an auteur and Michael Curtiz is sort of considered a journeyman.
Yeah.
But, you know, Curtiz made some incredibly great movies, so many great films and such a wide variety of films and musicals and Westerns and.
Well, just about every genre you can think of. Yeah. Yeah.
So why is Hawks an auteur and why isn't Curtiz? And is there something about Curtiz that you don't like?
No, I like Curtiz very much. He made a lot of films, and obviously plenty of them are not as good as the ones we treasure and remember. But I think Curtiz had this attitude. I think he was sort of like an expert car mechanic, if you know what I mean. So you brought your car in and it wasn't functioning. And Curtiz said, okay, give me a day with it and I'll work it out. And more or less, more often than not, when you came in at the end of the day, your car hummed and went perfectly. And it wasn't that he had put his personality into the film. He put his expertise. Whereas Hawks throw any kind of project at him, and he did many genres too, it quickly becomes a Hawks film. The women are Hawksian women. They're tough. They're slightly aggressive to the men in a way that was very unusual in films of those days. The men take this from the woman, and they enjoy the repartee and the conversation. His films are sexiest when the man and the woman are arguing. He's a master of that form, and it recurs. So that when Hawks takes your car, if you take that analogy, he sort of subtly recreates the engine. So it's not a Ford or a Mercedes or whatever. When you come back at the end of the day, the car goes beautifully, and it's a Hawks engine. It's got his personality to it. And that's why, for me, he is an auteur, an artist, or, you know, whatever you want to call it, pretentious terms. But his personality comes through in what he has done. And I find that personality funny, droll, teasing, downplaying. I find it very appealing. I think it's a very attractive personality. Whereas a personality of a Hitchcock, sort of more gloomy, more nagging, more depressive even, I find that not as pleasing as the Hawks personality.
Although Hitchcock's films are invariably funny.
Absolutely, yeah. Very sly, teasing comedy. Very English comedy. Yeah.
Back to those two Hawks films I watched, the I Was a Male War Bride and Man's Favorite Sport. Both of them have the male and female characters hating each other until suddenly they're in love.
Well, I don't know about you, but I think if you're going to have a lasting relationship with anyone of any sex, it depends upon a cultivated, reasonably restrained, combative energy. I do not like relationships where the people are always in agreement. Oh, yes, darling, you're so right. Absolutely. Oh, I'm so glad you said that because I was feeling that. I don't trust that sort of relationship. Whereas, what did you say? You mean so-and-so? Oh, come on. Don't pull my leg. I find that much more fruitful as a long-term basis for a relationship. Now, not everyone wants to go with that sort of slightly antagonistic energy, but I do. And it's a quality in the Hawks films that I like a lot.
Well, let me ask you about John Ford, because you sort of say you don't care for Ford much in your book, A Light in the Dark, A History of Movie Directors. And of course, you're a big fan of Welles, who you've written about in other books. And Welles said John Ford was his great influence.
Yeah.
that he'd watched Stagecoach repeatedly. And Stagecoach is such an incredibly great movie, in my opinion. Why does Ford not hold as much interest for you?
Well, I think that Ford stood for a certain sense of male heroism and prowess that I think is at the root of a lot of what's wrong with American films. I don't think he had that mocking edge that Hawks had. And he's a great storyteller. He's a very good director of actors. There's no question about that. But I just don't buy as deeply into the ideology as I do with the Hawks or with some other directors too.
You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro, and my guest this week is film critic and historian David Thompson. His new book is called A Light in the Dark, A History of Movie Directors.
Yeah.
Oh, you made a film, or you wrote a film about Gone with the Wind, which I like that film a lot. And I love Gone with the Wind. I want to talk about that with you. But I want to ask you about George Cukor, who directed so many people to their Oscar-winning roles.
Yeah. Great director of actors. Not a man who I think was able to generate his own material. He depended on writers, but he had the instinct to pick good writers. But once he'd got a good script, there were very few people who could handle star actors in it in the way he did. And also, you know, Cukor's one of those very interesting people who, without ever being known for being gay in his career outside the Hollywood inner circle, he was making films that said, well, I know that men are supposed to be like that, and I know women are supposed to be like that, but let's face it, in reality, it's a lot more complicated. There's no reason why good, smart films shouldn't get into that. And it's not that he ever made an outright gay film, because I don't think he felt he could. I think he thought that would be dangerous. But so many films he takes on, like Adam's Rib, are tugging at the sort of standard, orthodox relationships between men and women and trying to push and pull them in different new directions. And the work stands up very well because of that, I think.
Judy Holliday really shines when you watch Adam's Rib now.
Isn't she wonderful in that film? And there's a great scene where Katharine Hepburn just lets her have the scene. You know, and I mean, Hepburn was a big star. Holliday was not. She was very generous. Yeah, but Hepburn told Cukor when they shot that, he shot it first on Judy Holliday, and Cukor was prepared to shoot it from the other angle on Hepburn. And Hepburn said, oh, come on, George, don't bother with that. It's her scene.
That's amazing.
Hepburn was a remarkable woman. I spent a little bit of time with her, and she's one of the movie stars that I've met that I was most impressed by. Very smart woman, very egotistical.
Yeah.
Quite funny, but very open to the world going on around her.
And a fine actress. Really,
oh,
wonderful.
Terrific actress. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, I'd like to get into Gone with the Wind for a little bit with you.
Sure.
You know, one of the things that's happening now in movies is, you know, because we are so enlightened, every time we see movies now, we see all kinds of things, like you mentioned in Casablanca, for instance. Sexism and racism and gender bias, all kinds of things that, you know, we didn't see them, we didn't consider them until now. And does that make the movies, I don't know, how does that render the movie impossible, you know, to watch? I mean, I was watching Young and Innocent the other day because on your recommendation, I was reading this biography of Hitchcock that you recommended in your book. And I was watching Young and Innocent, and there's a, you know, the climax of the movie involves blackface.
Yeah.
And like blackface is just everywhere. Nobody thinks, nobody thought anything of it. It's absolutely. You can see Judy Garland, Mickey Rooney, Bing Crosby, Fred Astaire, all in blackface if you look for them.
I know.
I had a student complaining to me, an African-American student, that her English teacher made them watch a blackface film. And it turned out that she was talking about Olivier's Othello.
Yeah.
So how can we watch Gone with the Wind? And
well, I mean, this is a huge cultural question, which easily gets into what do we do with the statues of people we no longer seem to feel are worthy of statues. And I think it is invariably an opportunity for very skilled, subtle, curatorial work by teachers. I think that you can and should say, I'm going to show you The Birth of a Nation, because I think it's important that you understand what the world was like in 1915. And a part of that would be to say, in 1915, D.W. Griffith did something that combined so many elements in movie storytelling and editing in ways that had never been done before and affect us to this day. And it's worth studying just to see how film language developed. At the same time, I think one needs as a teacher to say, and now you have to realize that The Birth of a Nation was very controversial at its opening and undoubtedly helped revive the KKK. In other words, we've got to deal with the totality of the experience. And I would much prefer that to pretending that it didn't exist. The horrors in Birth of a Nation are not going to go away if we bury them. I think we need to spell them out and explore them. Now, Gone with the Wind is nowhere near yet in the category that Birth of a Nation is in now. You really can't show Birth of a Nation, just show the film, without some kind of commentary and educational elucidation. Gone with the Wind is getting there, because Gone with the Wind has racist assumptions, plantation society assumptions, that really very few people questioned in 1939. Some did. And they are horrendous, and they need to be dealt with, especially, I think, at a time when a masterpiece like the Underground Railroad, it's called a masterpiece, but in fact, if you talk to people, good people, people who like going to see good movies, they're not watching it because they find it too upsetting. God knows I understand that. The scene in the first episode of that where a man is hung and burned alive is appalling. But it's appalling because that kind of thing was done in this society and in this land. And we have got to come to terms with that. And there's no burying it. And in the same way, I think the show Gone with the Wind is an opportunity for showing how the world felt in 1939. A lot of things wrong with it. But Gone with the Wind was a film that our grandparents, probably, looking at you and judging your age, probably our grandparents were crazy over, in the way that we might be crazy over the great film of our moment. And I don't think we can disown that past, but I do think we have to explore it carefully. And you know, you're going to have students who feel very strongly and they should speak up in class. And if they feel they don't want to see the film, understood. but the art needs to be aired out.
I agree, but let me, with D.W. Griffith, you've got a guy who's a racist.
Yes.
But now you've written about extensively about David O. Selznick. You wrote a gigantic and wonderful book about him. He wasn't a racist, was he?
No. However, I mean, let me tell you this story. You probably know this story, but your listeners may not know it. When the film opened in Atlanta in December 1939, it was a huge event. And Atlanta was delighted to have the show. And it was a major publicity event. And when Selznick was talking to the people in Atlanta about what they were going to do for the opening, he said, and of course, we'll bring as many stars as we can. And the people in Atlanta said, great, great. Does that mean Vivian Leigh? Does that mean Clark Gable? Yes, 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 of course. And we're going to bring Hattie McDaniel because she is so fantastic in the film. And Atlanta said, oh, well, we'd rather you didn't bring her because we think if she is at the party and at the celebration, it will be awkward. Selznick blew it on that. He got very angry. He protested. But in the end, he went along with what Atlanta wanted. And then when Hattie McDaniel had been nominated as Best Supporting Actress, which she was the first person of color to win, instead of having her at the big round table center at the banquet where Gable, Leigh, Olivia de Havilland, everyone else was, he put Hattie McDaniel and her companion in a small table off in a corner of the room. Because I would not call Selznick a racist, but I will say I don't think he was able to handle race in the way that anyone in his position would handle it today. He was a person of his time, as we all are. We don't know, you and I don't know at the moment, the things we do casually without very much thought that may look horrible in 50 years, you know?
Or 20.
Or 20, or a couple.
Yeah, right.
And I think we have to be very charitable about the way actions and behavior can take on different feelings. So no, I would say he was not a racist, but I would say that he was a man who had a lot of very archaic ideas. He was a Hollywood producer.
He missed the opportunity. He missed the opportunity to be a hero there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I don't think it really occurred to him that he could have put Hattie McDaniel at the main table.
Well, I mean, he could have said to Atlanta, okay, fine, we won't do it then.
He could, but of course that would have been too big a blow to the promotion of the film. And he was a showman. He was a promoter of everything he was doing.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking this week with film historian David Thompson. His new book is called A Light in the Dark, A History of Movie Directors.
Well, what about silent films? Do you think there's an audience for silent films? And not only that, but, silent films have to be seen in a theater. And you can't watch them on TV because it's too distracting.
Well,
will theaters survive? Will we ever have movie theaters?
Well, now you're getting to the real question. Yeah. One of the great things about living in or close to the Bay Area, as we both do, is the San Francisco Silent Film Festival. I'm sure you've been to it sometimes, and I've been to it. And that is a long weekend where they play maybe four or five films in a day. And the theater, the Castro, the biggest theater in town, really.
With an organ.
Is packed.
Yeah.
And those people will sit there for any film you put on because they love silent cinema. And as you say, they love the companionship. They love being with an audience. They know a lot of people in the audience because year after year they go to the festival. And as you say, it's inconceivable that silent film could exist without packed theaters. And I can't remember the last time I really watched a silent film at home on my couch, but I know what you're saying. It just wouldn't work in the same sort of way. Now, as we talk, early August 2021, the film business is on tenterhooks over the whole matter of whether we, the people, are going to go back into theaters. And you meet a lot of people who say, oh, I'm just itching to get back into the theater and see a film. But, you know, theaters have been open for some time, and people who run theaters will tell you that people aren't going back. People are very afraid of going out in the open in crowds at the moment. And I don't think that that is diminishing nearly as quickly as maybe we hoped and thought it would do.
It's also the issue of habit. That is, when we were talking about films earlier, you mentioned a television series, The Underground Railroad.
Yeah.
We've gotten out of the habit of going to the theater.
Absolutely.
And the line between television and theater, as you've talked about in your history of television and in How to Watch a Movie, the line between TV and film and cinema, that has diminished greatly. Especially when you consider some of the movies like the Marvel movies that are just basically a television series projected on a big screen.
Yep.
It's definitely a changing moment in the history of the cinema.
Absolutely. And you know, one has to say this too, that going way back before COVID, maybe going back to the beginning of this century almost, you could make the case that the best long-form television series, and I'm, you know, you can think of The Wire, Sopranos, Breaking Bad, many others, those shows were at least as good as the best films playing in theaters, and to my mind, sometimes superior.
Well, there's one thing about having to fit your movie into 52 minutes. You know, an episode of Mad Men always has to have something that leads you to the next episode. It's almost like the old three-panel comic strips that Milton Caniff used to write, that you would, you know, you'd have some new story, but you'd also have an overarching story that's taking you from episode to episode and has to be concise. Whereas, you know, theatrical movies, especially those made, to my mind, in the 21st century, they kind of lag in the middle. That third,
don't they? Just
the middle act.
Yeah. No, I think you're so right. I think that a lot of these TV series have really regained narrative speed and conviction and force, and also, and here's a very important point: they have made the writer very important. Film cinema had become a director's medium. That's good and proper, and there's a lot of great things come out of that. But the writing is terribly important. And in television, the writer has become the showrunner. So you get people like David Chase, Vince Gilligan, who really are the auteurs on their series. And the quality of the writing year after year on those shows never flags. So that, you know, you take a show like Breaking Bad, if you think of how many years that ran, there's an amazing transformation in Walter White's character. And you live with it over a period of time. And originally, you live with it once a week. What we now find is that because of this binging technology, that habit, we only have to live with it like 2 weeks. You could get the whole Breaking Bad
75-hour long movie.
That's
seems like
right.
Eric von Stroheim was ahead of his time with Greed.
because I think, as you said, people like this new habit, and I think they're fond of it. And okay, they don't have the communal atmosphere of a packed theater, but they're probably watching with someone in the family, and there's a lot of conversation that goes on in that setting. And there's argument, and I like argument, as you know. And so I think that there's been a cultural change in the way we watch screens. And I personally do not think there is going to be the mass return to movie theaters. There will always be movie theaters of a certain kind, sort of like art galleries or museums even. They'll be attached to colleges, that kind of thing. But the mass habit, let's face it, the mass habit of going to the movies actually began to decline in the 1950s.
When television came along.
What we're really having to do now is to face up to that reality.
Scarlett Johansson's people, I don't know if it was her, but recently brought a suit against Disney for putting the Black Widow movie on TV.
Yeah,
and she's suing for the $300 million she would have made if it had only played in theaters for 120 days or something. It'll be interesting to see where that goes.
I'm afraid, I think she'll lose, but I think she'll lose public sympathy. I think, I think when people of that stature and reputation and glamour, and, you know, she's a very considerable actress. I think when they stick out for another $30 million, in this day and age, a lot of people say, well, okay, dear, you do that. But
I can understand her. I can understand her point of view, though, that
absolutely,
you know, I mean, but she's, you know, and again, I think it's her people, but the idea that in a pre-pandemic world, it's true. She would have made a lot more money.
Absolutely. And you know, she's in a business where there is still a lot of money to be made. And she's a competitive person, I'm sure. Why not? Yeah. And she says, well, why don't I get some of the money? You know, we'll see. It'll be, it could make a great movie one day.
It probably will. Oh, the thing about those movies that sag in the middle, and come back to Gone with the Wind for a minute. Gone with the Wind is a 4-hour movie.
Yeah.
But every single line of dialogue furthers the story. There is never a point in Gone with the Wind where you look at your watch and think, well, how much longer is this thing going to go on?
Oh, I think so. And I think that's always been vital to its impact and its success. And it's a measure of how the people who made movies, people like Selznick and George Cukor for that matter, and of course he was the first director in the film, they did not like small talk in their films. They did not like those lines that didn't go anywhere. And a line had to go somewhere, just as every individual shot had to go somewhere, so that the film held our attention from beginning to end. And you know, Gone with the Wind was a staggeringly long film when it opened, as it still is. But people had no trouble watching it. Same was true of Birth of a Nation. Birth of a Nation was so much longer than every other film that had been shown. And many people in the business said, oh, the audience won't sit still for that. But the truth of the matter is that if you put your film together with the precision that Griffith did and Selznick did, people will watch. And as we now know from binging, they'll watch all night if it works.
Yeah. Edwin S. Porter had a fight with Thomas Edison about whether people would sit still for 8 minutes of the Great Train Robbery.
It's amazing, isn't it? Just amazing. Yeah.
David Thompson, could you comment a little bit about the role of the editor in filmmaking and the relationship between the editor and the director?
Well, you know, obviously film is a photographic medium, so it's made of records of reality, and that's the source of its charm and its suspense and its drama. And we think of directors who decide this is what we're going to film, and that they do. But in many, many cases, the final decision about what we see is something that an editor will determine. And just as the lifelike nature of every individual frame is vital to a film, so is the way in which that film can change unrecognizably in a split second too quickly for us to close our eyes to it. So, you know, something very frightening can suddenly be shown in a calm, sweet, peaceful scene, and we sit up with a shock. And that's vital, and that is in the nature of editing. It's like the magician saying, "Now look, you see my hand? You see my hand? What you can't see is what I'm not telling you to look at. Boom, now I'm going to give it to you." And it's a medium made up of photography and editing. And I've always said to film students that, or to people who say they want to be film directors, filmmakers, the best education you can get for yourself is to beg your way into a cutting room and watch a film being cut. Because what you will find there is not just that a great deal of very precise work is done to execute the script, but, and it will shock you at first, you will see people suddenly say, "Well, you know, that character played by a well-known actor, that character's not doing anything for us. Why don't we cut that character out of the story?" And people say, "Well, we have a contract with him." And you say, "Well, okay, but it's not working with him. Suppose we take him out." And by that afternoon, everyone is wildly excited because they suddenly see how the story comes to life when a certain character is just dropped from the film. Now, that's a big change, but you know, there are lots of other ways, smaller ways, in which films change their shape, change their story during the editing, because the editing is so profound and so powerful. So it's a great experience for young people who think they understand the nature of photography, which they probably do because they take their own photographs, but they don't edit. And to watch how people edit and how quickly drastic decisions can be taken, that is a true education.
A lot of the editors in the golden age of Hollywood were women.
Yes.
Why do you think women were suited to it, or how did they manage to corner the market on editing?
It's a great subject, and I don't really have an adequate answer, but I think it's a measure of the fact that women editors worked with scissors and paste, if you know what I mean. And it looked like sewing, if you like. You know, you're sewing up a different scene. And I think that women were clever enough to see that they could get employment and agency because they realized that sometimes they could really be effective in making the film. And of course, it was an industry, and still is an industry, that is essentially very hostile to women in important jobs. There are still far too few female camera people. But editing and screenwriting are the areas where women got into work quicker than in others. And it's often a reflection of the way the business didn't take those crafts as seriously as they should have done, I think.
Well, David Thompson, I have written here on my paper about 75 questions that we didn't get to. And this book is a marvelous book, A Light in the Dark, A History of Movie Directors. And like most of your books, it's a series of lectures from you, which are always wonderful. And you mentioned how you love arguing. I've been arguing with you since the mid-70s. And here I finally got a chance to talk to you face to face.
Well, I'm sorry we waited so long, because it's
well. Will you come back?
Of course I will. I'd love to come back. I'm only up the road from you, so maybe one day, ideally, we could even be in the same studio space.
That would be wonderful.
Yeah, that would be great.
Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
I thank you very much.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.